What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Gadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, we finally have new MacBook Airs. It's been 2 years since the MacBook Air M2 came out, and Apple announced new models with the M3 chip, which we've just been waiting for forever. So we'll talk about that. We've got a bunch of news to dive into. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcast@gadget.com. iTunes also has a new feature to transcribe your podcasts automatically. Ooh. So let us know if you're doing that in iTunes. I want to know how people are using that feature. First up, though, MacBook Airs with the M3 chip. I was super excited about this. You know how I feel about the MacBook Air, Sherlyn, and you guys have yelled at me for using the word perfect too much in review headlines.
You use that for XPSs a lot, but you've stopped
XPSs
for sure,
yeah. Twice, and you know, if you deserve it, I'm going to use the word. It's there. It's a dictionary word, okay? How do you feel about these new M3-equipped MacBook Air, Sherlyn?
So in reading your review, I felt like, you know, these were just incremental upgrades over the M2, but that for people who are on Intel, like you used the word creakier Intel machines. And I thought that was such a great way to phrase it.
So creaky.
They're so creaky. And also the M1s, like, it sounds like these are, you know, going to be great because they include that redesign that we saw in the M2.
Yes. Yes.
But, you know, you've spent actual time with them. I'm not also sure. like a daily MacBook user. So,
well, I want to know what you think, yeah. Because I will probably be talking for a while. But I like, yeah. Full broad sketch. We have a new 13-inch MacBook Air, a new 15-inch. Both have the M3 chip. As always, the base model for the 13 has an 8-core GPU, but you can upgrade to a 10-core GPU. The 15 always has a 10-core GPU, which I think they need to do to run that bigger display. So that's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. But that's pretty much it. It's a new chip, same design. They did add a couple new features. What is it? There is finally dual external monitor support. So that's kind of cool. People complained about that with the base level 14-inch MacBook Pro with the M3 chip. But apparently now Apple has figured out a way. If you close the monitor lid, this computer can spit out two video feeds now because it's not sending one video feed to the built-in monitor. So that's something.
But but the lid needs to be closed, right?
The lid needs to be closed. So this is sort of like for hot desking if you go to an office, right? And there's just, if you look at our office right now, there's just tons of monitors everywhere and like plugs and stuff. And it's like some stations may have dual monitors. You can just sit down and plug in and be ready to go and you just don't have to open your computer. So I think for those people, that's not too bad. Maybe some creatives at home who also may have a dual monitor setup and don't really need the screen. I see people doing dual and triple monitor with their laptops all the time, and they have the laptop open and don't even use the screen. It's just kind of there. So that totally makes sense. I did ask Apple, like, so what is preventing you from actually, you know, supporting the screen open and two separate monitors? And talking to Apple is really weird sometimes because the reps will just then read back the stuff, the text that is in the thing we're all like following, like from the press release, like, yes, we've now enabled this feature so that when I was like, how do you do this? Okay. Like, how did you guys figure this out? And we have also learned that through a software update, the M3 MacBook Pro is also going to be getting this feature. So that's kind of cool. Okay. But I did ask, like, so how did you guys make this happen? Mm-hmm. And then Apple's like, yes, now with the lid closed, you can have dual external displays. I'm like, that's not, I know that. What I'm asking how. And Apple reps are kind of hilarious. So that is just talking to Apple. People often ask me, like, you really should grill these companies to get like more details. And we try. But some of these companies are very media trained.
I will put this out there just to quickly behind the scenes it a little bit for everyone. You know, again, I love behind the scenes things. I do think that like the PR people that we talk to sometimes are just under such strict, you know, they might be punished if they say the wrong thing. You know what I mean?
So like talking to people who work with Disney, right? Like they all imagine there's a sniper rifle aimed at their head. And if they say the wrong thing, I would hear this from
or
all
like
the time.
A chip implanted in their head, yeah, and then like they'll remote control trigger. Yeah.
But anybody working on like MCU stuff from Disney, when I talk to VFX people, they're like so careful because if anything gets out, that's it. That's the end of their job. Yeah. It could be bad.
It's not like they're Tom Holland. You know, he gets away with leaking shit by accident because he's a beloved character.
Young and dumb. Like he's a young kid and they're like, whatever, we can't get too mad at this kid. Anyway.
I didn't mean to derail, sorry.
External monitor support is a thing. Wi-Fi 6E is a thing. That's cool too, although you need a Wi-Fi 6E router to get that. Apple says it could offer twice as fast speeds as Wi-Fi 6. From what I've been reading, the way it uses additional frequencies is that it could potentially get you like gigabit speeds over Wi-Fi, which is cool. That's really rare to see. I think Wi-Fi 6, I don't know if you've like been tracking this for one, but Wi-Fi 6 was a pretty big upgrade in terms of like reception and overall speed. I'm running a Wi-Fi 6 setup here via AT&T Gigabit, and it's good. So much better than my old setup. But 6E sounds really good. And then we're also hearing about 7. So Wi-Fi just never ends.
Yeah, it's for me, it's like I'm still on a, I think mine is one of those ABGN type routers still. I know, it's an old one. I've used it for years and years. And I'm just like, look, if you do Wi-Fi 6, my next upgrade will be a 6 or 6E, right? But then like, then you tell me 7's on the horizon. I'm like, cool. I'm not going to keep upgrading my router. The router's the lowest priority.
No shade, Jolin, but you're covering two rooms. You have a little router that has to cover two rooms, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I don't have a lot of needs. Yeah, this is true.
So it's more one of those things. I will say, for everybody, upgrade your router for every 4 or 5 years. You will be shocked at like the difference. Just having slightly more stable internet, having more reception everywhere, it does make a huge difference, but we forget about our routers. So maybe that's a thing we should talk about at some point.
Yeah.
But anyway, for these computers, so we've got Wi-Fi 6E, we've got dual external monitor support. There is a Midnight Jet Black model now that has the fingerprint anodization to avoid fingerprints too, which is kind of cool. I have the 13-inch for that, and it seems to work. But beyond that, like these are the same machines we saw initially debut 2 years ago. The 15-inch model came out last year. Everybody was thinking that model was a little delayed because it is very strange that very quickly Apple is like ready to debut another one. And also you cannot even buy the M2 15-inch anymore. That model has just been disappeared. But yeah, these are the same computers. What is interesting is that they're starting a little cheaper. The M2 MacBook Air originally started at $1,199. The M3 model is going to start at $1,099 for the 13-inch, $1,299 for the 15-inch. And the M2 model is still going to be sticking around. It is the new $999 base model, which is kind of cool, which also means we're saying goodbye to the M1 MacBook Air, that old design that is basically a decade old, more than a decade old at this point. That is like the traditional MacBook Air design everybody can recommend. Pour one out for that one. How do you feel about that, Sherlyn? Like, do you want that design to stick around, or are you just happy to see it gone?
I still have these old machines, so I couldn't tell you that, like, they're gone from my life. You know what I mean? So it's not like I'm happy to see it. I guess I'm happy to see, like, when people buy a new laptop now, it will actually feel a lot newer. It will feel like a bigger difference. But to me, it was always, like, the M1 architecture, the M2 architecture that was more interesting than, like, the design itself, just because I don't think people, I don't know.
Definitely. Had a huge issue with that. I felt when I reviewed the M1 MacBook Air, I was like, this is incredible, but my God, that was like 2020 when all that stuff happened. And I was like, this is great hardware, but good God, Apple, you got to do something about this computer. Like this bezel is so big. Dell, bezel. Yeah, like since like 2013, 2014, Dell has been pushing like invisible infinity edge bezels, and they just look so cool and modern. And Apple's just like chunky bezels all the way forever. So that is gone. That's officially gone. I will say that computer has a place in my heart because when I started writing about technology and doing stuff, that was the first like good computer I was able to buy myself.
Which one?
And
the XPS?
The Air. Oh, like okay, Air. It was like a 2011, 2012 era MacBook Air. The one where they really hit good battery life and everything. That was certainly a time where I was like, oh, I've kind of made it to a point as a freelance writer that I could have this computer. I bought it on a loan, of course, but I could get this computer, and that was something.
Don't even get me started. Yeah, I have like a baby like 12-inch MacBook that I bought on loan as well. But like through this program that I wrote about called Grover.
Grover.
I think it's defunct now. I'm not sure. But that one, mine's at like baby 12-inch or 10-inch or something, like a teeny tiny MacBook. And I'm never letting that go. Like it's so cute as hell.
The 12-inch was very cute. A lot of people actually miss that whole 12-inch design, which is why even though the 13 MacBook Air actually has a 13.6-inch screen, a lot of people are like, Apple should just do a 12-inch or something. Although I'm thinking if you really want that, just get an iPad Pro. That's why the iPad Pro exists. You could get a baby 10-inch machine, you know, and get a decent keyboard for that. But yeah, that's pretty much it. Apple's saying like across the board, 20% faster speeds over the M2 when it comes to single core and multi-core functionality, significantly faster, up to 60% faster than the M1. Certainly a shit ton faster than the Intel chip. So that's all something. My review is live now. I really like these computers, but I think my overall takeaway is that they're great. They're fantastic. As always, spend a little more to get the 16 gigabytes of RAM, get a 512 gigabyte SSD. Basically, to get those things, you have to spend an extra $400 on top of these base prices. So expect to spend $1,499 for the 13-inch MacBook Air, but that'll be a computer you can use for 4 to 5 years and be happy with it. It also, they make the M2 Airs just like a good deal. Like, I think you could still find those computers around. You'll find refurb models, old models. You could probably get some great deals. You don't need to buy it new, but find a good one out there with the RAM you need and the storage you need and probably, like, be very happy with it. So that's the other thing. The M2 MacBook Air, still a good computer and, you know, still a good source of deals. How do you feel about that, Shirlin? Like, would you tell people you got to try to get a new one, or is saving money like the better alternative here?
I think saving money. I mean, I'm a fan of new things. So like refurbed models, you can always find a good deal. Yes. So like if that's really your need, go for it and find like a good like retailer or merchant or even Apple Direct refurbished, because that's generally safer. For me, it's more, I'm a big fan of new. And I know this doesn't help with the like whole eco-conscious, environmentally friendly sort of thing. But like when I buy new, then I keep it for like years and years. So
sure.
I think having that M2 MacBook Air option as new, direct from Apple or like Best Buy and Amazon, would be like the best way to go for people who are like price conscious and like don't need the latest and greatest. And again, like the differences are small, like you said, between the M2 and the M3
It's not huge, but I will say, $100 difference to get the slightly more powerful CPU. It depends. It's like on a case by case basis. From what I have seen, the M3 chip also supports real time ray tracing, so that's going to be a little better for games. I was able to play Lies of P in 1080p plus, which is 1920 by 1200, in high graphic settings and see 60 FPS like most of the time. So that is a shocking thing to see. For a computer that is so freaking thin, it's less than a half inch thin. It is 2.7 pounds. It has no fan. It is like it's just like a giant heatsink itself, and the M3, like the hardware is so efficient that they don't need fans. To be able to play a game that looks that good on a computer like this, like to me, that's amazing. Death Stranding Director's Cut also look good. Streaming games over Xbox, the cloud gaming stuff, also fantastic. So these are just like super useful, versatile computers. I love the way they feel. Check out my full review at Engadget.com, and we'll have a video review up soon.
I just to interject really quick, didn't you think that the like 15 inch was better? So I'm going to say like I looked at the laptop I'm using right now for recording this podcast and is the one that I use at home for work. And I'm like, oh, I guess I have the Windows equivalent of a 15 inch MacBook Air. Like
you have I don't know. Well, what are you running?
I'm using the Galaxy Book Pro 15 inch. And it's, you know, that big screen is really great. The big keyboard, nice. The keyboard has ample travel. This huge trackpad is great. The fact that it's thin and light and fanless, awesome. It's been serving me really well for like about a year plus now.
Yeah. I mean, I spend time with both computers, but I'm always like, I like portability. I'm mostly typing. I'm mostly doing like productivity work. So for me, like the smaller screen actually just feels better. And traveling with the 13 inch is better, but the 15 inch is like pretty light for its range. I think for older folks, visually impaired users, and anybody who needs like a bigger expansive screen, like if you're doing a lot of photo editing work, like, yeah, sure. That totally makes sense. It is a totally viable computer. It's just not as portable. It's more unwieldy to me. My day-to-day bag is like, it's from one of those San Francisco bag companies, but it's basically a tote bag that has everything I need to. And my ideal is when I can just slip a computer in there and barely even notice it. And with the 13-inch Air and most 13-inch computers, I can do that. With the 15-inch, I cannot do that. That is a big sucker. It's super wide. So you just got to think about those trade-offs.
Yeah, I do the same thing with like, and I know that like the position of privilege we're in to have like multiple laptops that we review or test that we can carry on. But yeah, I have like a Galaxy Book for my like daily. And then I have the 13-inch Galaxy Book Flex, I believe, like way back when they did QLED screens, which was great.
That's just thing, like a big walking Samsung ad over here.
I've never seen a
Samsung computer in the wild, Trillium. That is,
and it's,
wild
you know what's me. Really interesting? I think it's because I don't know if it's because like Samsung is the most recent company to have sent me laptops, but I can't say that's true because I think Lenovo has tried to send me stuff, and I'm just like, nah, I'm good, thanks. It's the fact that they're so thin and light and like easy to use.
I think before Microsoft got in the game, like the, I don't know if you remember this, but like 2010, 2011 era Samsung was making
the
super
thin. ATIV ones? The ATIV?
I don't know if it was ATIV, but they were super thin. And I do remember I used to visit, like, the Samsung had like a showcase, not quite a store, but in Lincoln Center, they had an area where you could go take a look at these computers. And I'm like, I like Windows. I like thin laptops. And it seems like they were pretty close to what Apple was doing with the Air. So I used to covet those. I guess they're still trying to do that. So, you know, that's something. But okay, MacBook Airs, they're pretty good, as you'd expect. Let's move on to some other news. And I think the biggest thing, you know, speaking of Apple, the EU has fined Apple almost $2 billion for potentially blocking alternative music apps. This is something we've been following for the past few years. The initial investigation opened in 2020 when Spotify filed a complaint saying Apple took steps to suppress Spotify due to competition with iTunes and Apple Music. It is the, you know, other services not getting the same kind of spotlight. But also a big part of this is that the EU Commission announced that Apple bans music streaming app developers from fully informing iOS users about alternative and cheaper music subscription services available outside of the app and from providing any instructions on how to subscribe to such offers. So that is why Spotify and other services, I think even Netflix, if you subscribe through iOS, you pay more. You pay more because developers are trying to cover the fact that Apple has to take a cut. I think it's still the 30% cut, right? But Apple takes a cut, so you just pay more as a consumer. And the EU is like, well, this is kind of unfair because then people don't know that if you go to the website, you can subscribe to these other things and save a couple bucks a month. And they ended up fining Apple over this, and this is a huge freaking fine. 1.8 billion euros, $1.95 billion. This is the third largest fine that the EU has ever announced and the first major fine for Apple from the EU. This is just huge. This is just, we talk about like Apple just swimming with money and having so much cash available. Like, this is a big knock against them and their practices, and this is something they've done for the past 10 years. Like, how do you feel about this, Sherlyn? Like, this practice of basically not only pushing developers to essentially charge more for the same service but preventing them from even telling users that you can get it cheaper elsewhere.
I first of all wasn't really even aware of the practice, haven't really been following the investigation. I think it does take like big companies like Spotify and like in the music streaming game too, like Spotify's Apple Music's like biggest competitor. And if we hadn't like seen this sort of competition or like a big name calling out with the money and legal team backing it, calling out Apple, that like you would quickly see this like Apple Music take over and dominate. And that's one less area, you know, where we would see competition providing good, compelling services, right? So like in general, I think it's good that we're seeing this happen, that the EU is slapping this massive fine, that it's drawing attention to the issue. I will say the post that we have ends with saying that Apple plans to appeal the decision, because I was like, oh yeah, the EU did fine Apple, but is Apple going to pay? Was always really my question. And it looks
they'll
like
always
Apple,
try to appeal. Everybody tries to appeal.
Always try to appeal.
I mean, it's a two-pronged problem, right? It is Apple basically kind of blocking people from being aware of other services, but also overcharging consumers of those services because of their own like App Store policies.
And I think that's like, where that's what led to the fine being as huge as it is, probably, right? Like, the monetary aspect of it adds to the whole, the severity of the complaint. Yeah.
Because this has been going on for 10 years, too. They're like, you know, there's consumer harm here. There is, like, those are all the reasons. Like, the EU is really taking Apple to task here. It is kind of interesting, though, that Apple, I mean, Spotify is the market leader in streaming music. It does feel weird when Spotify is like, boohoo, EU, you're our homies. Right. We're a European company. Big bad Apple over here is treating us badly. This feels very much of the like Sony and Microsoft thing too. Was like, listen, yeah, Sony complaining about Microsoft and Microsoft being like, oh, we're not that big. It's a weird thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, since we're talking about Spotify a little bit, it's kind of like, I see it as a bit more like big names get more airtime and more like coverage and that sort of thing. And maybe there are little companies that didn't get the attention that actually might benefit from stuff like that. But who knows? But it reminds me of when like Taylor Swift decides to speak up for because music services weren't paying them for their, you know, paying artists enough. And yes, she should be the last one to complain about not making enough money, but she did sort of, I guess, rising tide up all boats kind of situation. I you know,
they will
to focus
pay attention
on the positive
to Taylor Swift complaints, yes.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So like to focus on the positive, there is a side benefit, even though I agree with you that the big companies and the big celebrities making billions of dollars flying to private jets everywhere should be the last ones to make all the noise. But then sometimes they're the ones that can be heard. So
that's just how it goes. So anyway, Apple's under hot water here. We also saw the news that iOS 17.4 has been released this week, enabling third-party app stores in the EU, because the EU really pushed Apple on that stuff and really like closing off iOS and everything. So that's only in the EU. You'll be able to get some of that. And like we mentioned up top, Apple Podcasts is going to do automatic transcriptions for podcasts in English, Spanish, French, and German. Reading from our report here, the text will be highlighted in sync with the audio to make it easy to follow along. You'll be able to search the text and tap it to start playing the audio at a certain point. So that's cool. That is.
It's also, and I spoke with just friends in the accessibility space briefly about this. I think as podcast creators also have the ability to download the transcription that's, I think, automatically generated. And then we can correct it ourselves to ensure.
Oh, that's cool.
Like, this really reduces the work, the amount of work that creators need to do to, like, you know, have accurate transcripts for people who may have like hearing impairment or are hard of hearing to follow along. So I think that's awesome.
That's something. I mean, this is only, again, this is Apple's garden. So this are transcriptions
Apple
for
Music.
Apple Podcasts.
Yeah.
So
sorry. Yeah.
That is the biggest platform, certainly, but podcast hosts will also have to do these transcripts elsewhere too. So I wonder if this makes it easier just to like copy and paste it to other platforms or to a website or something. Hey, this is not something we're doing right now, but we've been talking about it and I've been looking for solutions for it. So I'll likely be using Mac Whisper or something to help like generate some transcriptions for us that we'll go in and correct. This is a functional thing for usability, so it's good to see the feature. I just don't know if it's like, it's not going to be, it's going to be an annoying thing for creators, but ultimately great for the users. So I think that's a good thing,
yeah.
Right?
Speaking of accessibility features, this week Microsoft is actually holding its Ability Summit, which, you know, basically highlights and raises awareness about its accessibility developments and collaborations. I have a piece about that on the site that I will talk a little bit more about later on this episode. But that also reminds me that this week Microsoft confirmed it will host an event around Surface and AI on March 21st, so later this month.
A virtual event too, so we don't have to travel for it, so
thank
that's nice.
Goodness. I mean, I don't mind events, you know, in person because they're fun, but they're a lot of more effort than they are than the virtual ones.
I mean,
but anyway,
we talked about the last Microsoft event, which was kind of a crap show
AI
in New York
only.
City.
Yeah,
so that
yeah,
was
yeah.
Again, I feel like they're just like taking a break a little bit after that one.
I guess I could, you know, not eat catered food for one event. It's my favorite thing about events, all the free food.
I mean, so there was a report from Windows Central saying that Microsoft was planning to announce the Surface Pro 10 and Surface Laptop 6 this month, and looks like this is going to be the event where that's going to be happening. So certainly we'll be following along with this and covering it and everything. Are you excited at all about this, Sherlyn? Like after all
you
the
know what?
Copilot yeah. AI stuff, yeah?
Actually, I was going to say no, and then I realized actually two things. One, I am excited to see what like a hardware from Microsoft looks like without Panos. Panay,
it's the same hardware
for Amazon.
It's the same hardware. Like nothing.
It is the same hardware. I understand. Yeah. But I'm also excited to see what an event hosted by someone like a Surface event by someone other than Panos looks like. Even though I know the last one that we saw was already like after
the last one was just like, well, listen, Panos got basically switched to Amazon within a week of
right.
that last event.
Right.
Remember? That was kind of like, oh man, our headliner's gone. Our Taylor Swift is gone for our event.
Right.
What do we do?
Let's get Olivia in there, right? Quick. I want to see who their Olivia Rodrigo is. You know. Like,
that
I want to see.
That'd be great. Well, I remember that the New York one, Satya Nadella also appeared for like 5 seconds. It was like, hey guys,
he
AI.
You can add. They flew him out on their private jet. They were like,
amazing.
Yeah, you need
amazing
to come
stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is going to be a Surface and AI event. Listen, I would recommend, I wrote a piece in December about like what Microsoft is doing with Copilot and how like trouble their future seems. My original title for that piece was going to be Microsoft has no clue what it's doing with Copilot. I still kind of feel like that's the case, because over the last few months, we saw the launch of Copilot Pro, which I'm testing right now. That's the $20 a month service for better, you know, better AI stuff, for better generative levels and faster responses and things like that. Better images, I believe, too. I don't know if people actually like using Copilot. Like, I've talked to people in companies and IT people who are like trying to deploy this and trying to get their users to do it. And people are just like, people just don't really care, other than the ability to like magically get like a cool response. You know, you type in a search engine, you get a cool thing, or it generates an email for you or something. But people aren't like integrating it into their work lives in the way Microsoft wants them to.
Yeah.
Do you think that will actually happen, Trillin?
So I think there's two parts to this. One, in that, like, yeah, there's that novelty feature of like seeing the difference in the new results that are AI generated. And then there are the people who use it for some work, but not a lot. Then, you know, bearing in mind, I recently spoke with Microsoft for the Abilities Summit, and this is coming from the company itself. So, you know that it might be like a source with vested interest in saying this thing. But like, you know, according to surveys that Microsoft has done, people who are neurodiverse seem to find like Copilot and Microsoft 365's like generative AI features helpful, in that like it shortens the time taken between thought to action, you know, that sort of thing. You've got some Copilot accessibility features enabled starting today. So like, it's hard to see, you know, how that will impact people in the future, because it's just launched, really made available. But it's things like, you know, asking Copilot to turn on live captions, asking Copilot to like read something aloud, that sort of thing would be, I can see how it would be helpful. I just don't think we're getting like a full picture just yet.
For sure. It feels, the thing is, like, it just feels like Microsoft just wants to like shove this on us so quickly. And I wonder if that's a bit of a turnoff. Like,
I think
that
the
is
buttons,
like, Copilot, all the things, Copilot integrated in your start menu, Copilot in Windows everywhere, Copilot in Edge, Copilot in Office and Teams. And I don't know. I felt like they spent all this money investing in OpenAI. They're like, well, we got to do something with this, you know, like we got to have something to show for it. And it would have been nice if like they had waited maybe a year or so to have like a lot of these features more fully baked. Because I don't know. I'm just a little, I feel like this is clippy all over again, even though some of the stuff works pretty well too. There was the news about a Microsoft engineer who, I believe, escalated issues they found with the Microsoft Designer. That is the image, the AI powered image search stuff. And that product's it is delivering like sexualized images, hyper-violent images. They've complained about it. They've been complaining about it for months, and Microsoft has not really responded. And at one point told him, just talk to OpenAI, like bring this up to OpenAI, because we're not in charge of this stuff. Those are the things where I'm like, these companies aren't really interested in fixing the problems with AI. They want a thing. They want the buzzword that they can market so that their stock goes up ultimately, that other companies respond and people use their products because they see the buzzword. So that's my concern. I guess we'll see where this goes. Yep. But hey, let's talk about Microsoft bringing up buzzwords and things that would really excite developers and people. Let's talk about Android apps and Windows, right? Trillin, we're all using that.
I gotta say, this news post was a journey for me. So first it was kind of surfaced in our, you know, news discussion channel. It's like, is this a thing? And like, for people to just be,
did
like, is this a thing? And
then, the Android,
yeah, we're like, oh, right, this existed. And so it first came out, and we had to parse this like strangely worded headline from a competing publication. I would not mention who, but like something about the Windows subsystem for Android and like the Amazon App Store is going away. But really, effectively, Microsoft ended support for Android apps that it introduced, I think, something like in 2020 or 2021, something like that, with the launch of, yeah 2021, thank you, with Windows 11, saying that it will support Android apps. We were like hype. You know why? Because this was about, remember, one of my pet topics back then, Devendra, ARM-based PC. Windows on ARM. And like Windows 11 was supposed to be like a bit better for that because of, you know, Android app support and that sort of stuff. So now, with, I guess, very little fanfare, first of all, but also, like, I mean, obviously you can't have fanfare celebrating the demise of Android app support, but it seems as if Android apps were used so infrequently on Windows 11 that they were like, yeah, we don't need to maintain an entire
subsystem
for this.
Can I put this more simply, Sherlyn?
Please do,
nobody gives a shit? How about that?
Yes, I mean, I found the, like, indirect, not very, the like, nice way.
Can I read the Microsoft way comment? The Microsoft comment that we got is, as part of our commitment to meeting evolving customer needs, we periodically update our product offerings. This involves introducing new technical innovations and retiring products. Microsoft remains dedicated to an open platform and ecosystem, and we look forward to continuing to bring the best experiences and apps to Windows.
I mean, look.
I love this statement. It says nothing.
It tells me that, like, Microsoft is happy to experiment, and then when the experiments don't work, it's happy to kill. You know, like,
which
it's
is fine.
Like,
that's what you should do. Fine. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And like it experimented with the Duo, right? The phone, you know, it did do some integration with Android there, bringing Microsoft apps to.
I mean,
like,
it ran Android, you know? So yeah.
It ran Android, and the fact that like it worked with with Google to kind of make the interface, you know, the span and the different modes that it would have the keyboard floating on one side and the and not like it experimented with Android that way with Google for specifically the Duo, but yeah, I mean. I guess it makes sense.
Let's specifically say what this is. So when Microsoft added Android support to Windows 11, actually, I believe it was Windows 10 before this too. So yeah, it was in Windows 10 before. But I remember being at Build where Android apps on Windows, that's cool. Oh, it's actually through the Amazon App Store, which doesn't have all the apps you want. It has no Google apps, by the way. So...
And
the
also,
crummy subset of Android stuff. Yeah.
So yeah, the Amazon App Store is something that I weirdly hold dear to my heart because when it first launched, the Amazon App Store was like, everybody was like, why are you doing this? But then they actually made certain like benefits within some Android apps free. So, like, if you have in-game purchases, if you downloaded them through the Amazon App Store, sometimes you could get those in-game purchases for free.
That's called bribing. Anyway, yes.
True. And I succumbed to that for some games for a minute there. Uh-huh. Like, if Heads Up for a minute was, like, free on the Amazon App Store, but, like, paid on the Android apps. Anyway, the Amazon App Store is one way you could get apps in Windows 11 or Windows 10 before that, maybe. But also, Microsoft was making some of these Android apps available through its own App Store when it announced this, like, support. And I think that's, you know, and making it work better with Windows 11, integrating it that way was part of the Windows subsystem thing that has since retired.
I'm just correcting myself here. So this news, the whole Android thing. So like Windows 11, that all came so hot and heavy in 2021. So yeah, Android apps appeared there first. I think there was talk about eventually bringing some of that stuff to Windows 10. I think it was just the improved store, not the Android apps. I don't know. Nobody cares. Like nobody cares. I think that's.
I guess
the
nobody clamored
thing.
For it.
Nobody it clamored was... for it. Yeah.
It was very newsworthy. I think on our end, we were like, yes. But then you think about the Windows experience and using any sort of mobile app, it's still not great. And I think that's kind of why it went away. There's no like Android app I'm dying to use on my PC, you know?
It's Microsoft's execution problem, right? It is like Surface Duo was a great idea, but they could not execute on Android and that software. And I felt like they weren't fully committed to the software, even though the hardware is pretty cool. Like, that's the thing. Like, Microsoft just doesn't know... Hey, we're going to bring some Android apps to Windows, but rather than like play nice with Google and just be like, "Hey, this benefits us to get like a full experience here." They're going to go to like the crummy app store at the bad mall that you don't go to, you know, the one where you don't want to leave your car parked, and they're going to go to Amazon and be like, "Can we have some of your apps?" And that's essentially what happened, and nobody cared. Nobody cared about those apps because not many were the ones people actually wanted. So anyway, RIP Android apps in Windows. If you actually use them, if you care about this feature, are you sad it's going? Let us know because I want to know. I want to talk to you.
Please tell me what app you were using on Windows because maybe I would.
Podcasts and Gadget.com. You want to mention something, Sherlyn, about Pixel phones too.
Yes, mostly because I was surprised how much interest it was getting, I think. I saw that like this article was popping. I was like, all right. So this week, Google announced it is bringing its next gen call screening feature to some Pixel phones. It was initially, you know, on the Pixel 8 Pro, I believe. And it basically improves upon the existing call screening feature where like if, you know, on Android phones, this is one of my favorite features on Pixel phones, by the way, which is that like when your call comes in and like it's a number you don't recognize, you can hit like call screen and it'll have this like, you know, Pixel Google Assistant voice, I guess, saying things like, oh, the person, you know, you're calling is not available at the moment, leave a message. And then you can see the transcript of what the person is saying like in real time on your phone screen.
That's cool.
Yeah, which is really helpful. And then you can either say, I can't talk now or whatever. Like you had a few canned options as to like what to do with this person. You can answer the call. You can say call back later. You can say like, give me more info or whatever. Now it's the next gen version brings you a few more options as to what you can do during that sort of like screening process. You can say, in addition to just saying, tell me more, you can always ask why. You can say, basically ask for more information. It will also ask the Google Assistant to speak on your behalf. This is the new, like,
you're interacting with the call with without answering it, but you're still looking at your phone and interacting with the call. And I do wonder if you take the time, how much time would it take you to answer the phone and just tell the have this conversation rather than do the tippy tappy?
Yeah, I mean, we've mentioned accessibility a few times, so like I will say that there's a clear accessibility like benefit here. But also for me, sometimes like I'm on the podcast right now. If my Pixel phone started just ringing, I could still record the podcast, but also look at my like phone and see who is calling. Is it urgent?
Sure.
You know, is this delivery something that I can handle with an assistant's voice?
In this next gen call screening thing, that's just a transcript. Seeing the transcript is cool. I agree. It's cool that Pixel phones have that. To me, this feels like the Google reservation stuff when Google Assistant calls a restaurant.
It is duplex, absolutely.
Kind of does that thing. And this is where I reiterate my point is that this feels freaking rude. Isn't this a little rude? Like, you're not, you already feel bad if like you're calling somebody and you go straight to voicemail. But now the person on the other end is engaging in this cat and mouse conversation where they're like, oh, I don't care about you enough to answer the phone or send you to voicemail, but I will hit these buttons to be like, who are you? Why are you trying to talk to me? Are you interested?
Two things.
This feels rude.
Devendra, two things. One, I have accidentally deployed, not accidentally, like deliberately, but without knowing the caller, deployed Google Assistant to be like, yo, I can't talk right now. Who the hell are you? Right. Yeah. On the person I actually know. Uh-huh. And the person was like, yo, it's me. Like, and I read the transcript and the person said their name and I was like, oh crap. And I was like, oh no. And then like, I quickly answered. I was like, oh, sorry. Like whatever. And they're like laughing. They're like, I could see on the transcript too. It was like, how dare you?
How did they feel? They felt it was rude, huh?
I mean, of course they felt a little snubbed, but I will say that from my point of view, it feels like I have an assistant that's like actually helpful. But anyway, the second point I wanted to make.
You're important was enough that Devendra, to have an assistant. Yes, yes.
Right. Devendra, do you like when Google first started introducing the smart reply, smart suggestion type features in email, did you also feel the same way? Did you feel it was rude?
I don't use them. I don't use them ever. I do. Like, if I get the canned, again, it's the same things. Like,
it's not canned though. It's getting better.
It's canned. They are canned responses. Like, yes, I agree. Something like that. Sounds good.
Okay. So confession time. Confession time.
This is not actually Sherlyn. This is a bot.
90%. Yeah. 90% of the PR emails I get in my inbox that I do reply to, which I only respond to maybe 5% of them. 90% of the time I'm clicking the chips that appear below that like Google service. They're like, sounds great. Thanks. Awesome. Thank you. And like whenever they're appropriate, I just like use those. So like I find them helpful.
But that's like a low impact conversation. That's not like, by the way, I have to agree to this embargo and like respond to some questions. Like that is the high touch stuff. For the simple like, hey, that's great. Thanks for this info. Yeah, yada, yada. That's great. Specifically this feature, I do feel like Google, the accessibility usefulness is there. Totally there. But I do feel like for able-bodied folks, like folks who could just pick up the phone, this is a weird thing where we're like doing this weird game where it's like, I get it. I don't like answering the phone either, but I just let it go to voicemail. That's my thing. Like, I will just let go of the voicemail. If it's important, I will get back to them. Whereas this is like, this is some weird power play. This is just like, oh, you can't talk to me, but you can talk to my robot, me, and I'm behind in the background pulling the strings of the AI assistant. I find it hilarious. And that's also why I don't use the Google Assistant for reservations either. To me, it feels bad.
That. I mean,
it feels bad.
That one's bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
I will point out that like anything that has to do with like people who are in high stress situations and you're like having a machine talk to them, it's not a good idea.
Yes.
Especially people who are manning or like running the front of a restaurant and like trying to deal with reservations at busy hours, that's not going to work very well.
It's not cool. Nobody has patience. That's not kind to the service workers. That's not – it's just like – I don't know. I'm just really, really sad about that. We live in a society and sometimes – we have to talk to each other. let's talk about Nintendo next, because Nintendo is a company I love, but occasionally they do things that I think aren't so great. And that includes like being very, very heavy-handed legally when it comes to attacking people who are developing emulators or selling emulators. So we saw the news this week that the emulator developer Yuzu settled, or the developer of Yuzu, Tropic Haze, settled with Nintendo for $2.4 million. Nintendo says that they were enabling piracy at a colossal scale. Yuzu, the emulator, is like one of the best Switch emulators out there. It is, it's the way you've been seeing like super high res Zelda, I believe Tears of the Kingdom, the early footage that was out there through a cracked copy of Tears of the Kingdom was also like being played via Yuzu. Hey man, this is unfortunately what happens. Like Nintendo is very, very heavy handed with this stuff. Like they go after people all the time when it comes to anything around piracy. They went for Switch piracy websites a couple years ago. They sued the ROM sharing website ROM Universe for $2 million. They helped send the hacker Gary Bowser to prison. They sent Bowser to prison. That's how hardcore Nintendo is, okay? It's one of those things, like, I totally get the use case where people are like, you know, it's great to have emulators for game preservation. We lose a lot of things if we don't have ways to play older games. And Nintendo's not a company that's always interested in, like, keeping a lot of this stuff alive. It's only recently we've seen, like, more emulators on the Switch. The Switch as a platform is a really good way to highlight some of the best older games. But I get the game preservation, you know, response that, hey, this is not great if we cannot play these games in other ways beyond Nintendo's hardware. But let's also be real that most people are doing this for piracy. Like you see the forums, you see people talk about Yuzu, like they're doing it for piracy. A handful of people are being noble from what I've seen and are actually buying games and then dumping the ROMs or getting the ROMs and buying the game so they can play them on their PCs at a much higher resolution. And that I can understand because, hey, I'm a PC gamer too. It feels really weird to be going to my Switch and playing, you know, Zelda in 30 FPS sub 1080p. And on my freaking my desktop computer can like run Zelda in real time 4K and just like have crazy lighting effects. So I get it. I get the impulse. I just wish I wish Nintendo like worked better with these companies because they're just so heavy-handed about protecting their IP. That's the ultimate thing. Do you have any thoughts about this, Sherlyn?
I mean, I'm surprised in large part because I know emulators exist and like, you know, there's some that I use sometimes when I like am craving
don't
some
tell
of my
Nintendo
old Flash games.
They're gonna come at you.
Oh no, this is Flash games, like, uh-huh. Like nothing to do with Nintendo, nothing to do with their licensed branded characters and whatnot. Like stuff that indie creators back in the wild west of the internet made. And I wonder what would happen to them, right? Like I doubt indie creators would be out there suing every single emulator service, but there are some big titles in there. There mm-hmm. are games that I played when I was little with my cousins, like Little Fighter. Those were one of our favorites. And we keep talking about how emulators are bringing them back and we're so excited for the nostalgia of it.
There are Flash game emulators now. And I think the Internet Archive runs a couple of those. So that's kind of cool.
So that's where my like feeling of like siding a little bit with the emulator people is.
I get it.
Nintendo is a little bit like, this is our property and whatnot. Then do it yourself, bro. Like,
yeah, you offer something better. The thing is like Nintendo ignores PCs entirely. Like Nintendo is so focused on their own stuff and like only controlling what it is releasing and putting out there. So I don't think Nintendo will ever do what Sony did. Like Sony has finally been like, okay, PCs are cool. We like PCs. We'll release games on PCs. Not quite happening with Nintendo, unfortunately. But at the same time, I still think like they're among the better video game companies out there when it comes to worker rights, when it comes to treating consumers mostly fairly.
Yeah,
I think that stuff tends to be better than a lot of other folks. But hey, it's unfortunate. No company will fully embrace emulation, unfortunately. We also saw the news this week. Logitech came back with a webcam. They announced the Logitech MX Brio, which Sam Rutherford calls a big upgrade in image quality. Calls a party trick too. You can like tilt it down to get a view of your desk to get like an overhead view, which is cool. I will say it is very cool to see Logitech still be in the space. I think the Brio and the the last camera that they had, I've used that as well. Their cameras are good. Their accessories are good. The Brio came out in 2017, was a 4K camera at the time. notoriously like buggy and a little unreliable. So it's kind of cool that they have finally updated it with, hey, 4K again, 4K 30 FPS. It's in the MX family. So that's their more premium accessory family. Are you intrigued by this one, Sherlyn?
I mean, remember RIP when we did the live stream, which we've not forgotten, dear listeners, that I know are asking for the live stream.
A lot of things have been changing. Yeah.
We're working on things. That was my go-to. That was a camera that I was, you know, sent to use, the Logitech Brio. And it was so weird. The mount just wasn't reliable at all. It kept like toppling. Yeah. And so the addition of this hinge that allows it to bend over, I think can also allow it to do other things and maybe be a bit more sturdy when sitting up on top of my, say, laptop or whatever mount.
That was such a weirdly flimsy camera, I recall. Yeah. I don't know what they were thinking.
I didn't see this in person, but from what Sam describes, it sounds like, you know, it's like a premium upgrade in terms of that build. So maybe, you know, with the MX branding, this is a better device.
It looks like a better device. We have talked about, I think it was the Logitech Stream Cam. That was the 1080p one, more for consumers. And I think I sent you one of those, Sherlyn. I also have one like hanging around my desk. It is good to have secondary cameras, especially when you're doing video streams. But what is cool about this one is that, hey, you can just like tilt it down and get like an over, you know.
Mm-hmm. Remember how we used to struggle with that on our Engadget podcast live stream?
We used to struggle. At some point, we will start that back up and we're going to have these same problems again. So anyway, this thing is cool. It's going to cost
$199. So about the same price.
And it looks like a cool piece of hardware, but at the same time, like, there are cheaper webcams out there too. This is like in the premium line with like the Razer Kiyo. Big sensors, big Sony sensors to try to get better quality and low lighting. Whatever you get, folks, get a light. Get a nice little key light. If you do a lot of video chats or if you want to stream or whatever, light matters more than your sensors. That's like the ultimate thing here. All right, let's move on to stories from around Engadget. Sam Rutherford also reviewed the Nothing Phone 2A. He calls it a budget phone that's packed with personality, has a 6.5-inch 120Hz OLED screen, a 5,000 milliamp battery, unique design. It's only $349? That's wild. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the specs, this is like, it is a mid-range phone, but with like budget price. Which is interesting. To be clear, though, there are some caveats. Like, for example, if you're here in the U.S. and you want to buy, you first have to sign up for Nothing's developer sort of membership program.
Boo.
It's free. You don't have to jump through too many hoops. But you do, like, the fact that it has this sort of, like, little hoop you have to jump through is kind of not fun for me. But it's available elsewhere in the world, like, more widely accessible. Mm-hmm.
It's a cute phone. I think it's a good-looking, like, weird sci-fi-looking phone, yeah.
I think that's awesome. I think that the fact that Sam honed in on the fact that like, it looks with like it has got such great personality in terms of its appearance, the dot matrix UX, the like transparent case. We don't see phones like that a lot nowadays, right? We've complained multiple times.
The LEDs on the back, which are kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah, we've complained how like Samsung's phones are looking like, you know, iPhones. I don't know what the next Pixels are going to look like, but I will give it to Google. Pixels have a distinct look, right? They're phones, but it's not my favorite look. I think the Nothing has a better design. So, yeah.
It's cool. Like, yeah, I would be interested if, like, people in the U.S. actually buy this thing because that price is actually pretty good. Because what does the Pixel A's, like, what do they cost at this point?
$450.
Yeah, that's the more Pixel 7 for less features.
Exactly. But I will point out that the Nothing phone, another caveat in the U.S. is that, like, if you're an AT&T or Verizon user, I believe, you do not get 5G on the Nothing phone 2A.
Nothing. You give me nothing. Nothing. Oh, man. I'm also at their website. They're also one of the weirdest companies when it comes to marketing stuff because they have, like, high-res, you know, photos of, I don't know, hipsters wearing phones, I guess. And then you scroll down to the ear tube black, and it's just the weird beetle that has like the horns, the horn beetle again.
Yes, remember? Remember when they did that?
You want that imagery right next to something you're plugging into your ear? Really?
Remember they did, what was it, the parrot or something?
But it is still there. It is still, I'm scrolling down, I see a giant beetle. With all their marketing images, I don't know what's going on over there. Nothing, but okay.
Look, they're being quirky, and I like it. And I mean, look, the back of the Nothing Phone 2A, by the way, the two cameras sit in the middle and give it like a sort of face that Sam has described as looking like an emo WALL-E, and that's pretty cool. I mean, like it's It's got personality. It does look like a face. It looks like a sad robot. So if you want a sad robot of a phone, and or you just want to see what this thing looks like, check out Sam's review on our website.
For sure. I love the quotes Nothing has put on their website from the site High Snobiety. High Snobiety. The quote is boundary pushing aesthetics from GQ. The quote is the most hyped tech company in years. That's not necessarily good. That's just, also that's just hype. Anyway.
It's also not the most hyped tech company in years. Come yeah, seriously. Is an OpenAI way more hype? Like, come on.
In other stuff GQ, around what are you doing? I do want to shout out my own review of Dune 2. I talked about it a bit last week, but I wrote an article saying Dune 2 kicks butt. And I talk about
it was so good.
The Dolby Cinema transducer experience, like how the seats rumble and stuff. Yeah, go check out that piece. It was fun to write. It is weird that Dolby didn't want to talk about that feature. And they're like, that's an AMC feature. And then I talked to AMC and they're like, we don't know. We have nothing to say on these seats. So this thing was implemented. It has been designed in these things.
It's actual components. Yeah. It's actually things inserted into these seats, right?
Yeah. They're essentially rumbling in the seats. It's just wild to me that these companies just don't really want to talk much about it. I don't know. I don't know what's up there, but go check out my piece. Let's move on to what we're working on. I'm finishing up a review of the Roomba Combo J9 Plus. This is Roomba's latest flagship machine, and it is both a vacuum and a mop. It's a vac mop. And I love this thing.
A vop.
It's a vop? I don't know.
The mop? The mop.
It is a bop, though, because what it does is I turn it on and it vacuums my floors. And right after, right on the front vacuum, the back mops. And it just it just goes around my house doing that. And it is like, I have missed having clean floors for so long.
So it's Sherlyn. Eating at the same time as it's peeing? You know what I mean?
Is that sort of. So, I mean, it's peeing and it's cleaning up after itself. So that's helpful. Yeah. It's all
clean
like
pee. It's clean pee
at this point. But it's kind of cool. Like, it is a very hands-off device. Like, I fill up the tank in the like little base, the charging base it has. It fills itself up. It charges itself. It dumps the waste. And I just walk away. And I come back home, and my floors are clean. It's magic, Sherlyn. Like, I never have time to mop my floors because my children are little terrors, and I'm busy with work most of the time, and my wife is also, like, busy with the kids. So, like, we don't have time to do those things. This is sort of like the ideal Roomba to me. So, anyway, check out my piece. It'll be going up next week at some point. Sherlyn, what do you want to chat about?
I will say... editing you this week has been a joy, Devendra. There have been so many great lines in your Dune piece, in your Roomba piece. I just could, I have this like file in my mind where I'm like, Devendra has this great line, and I like it just keeps getting longer this week. So I'm mildly annoyed. I'm also like, can you cool it down a little bit?
Good lines. Sorry.
It's great lines. And so whenever that Roomba review goes up, I am very excited for people to go and read it because it's going up next week. So maybe bookmark that, people. I'm like, excited for people to get the mental image of you taunting the Roomba robot vac with like a piece of cat poop, just like dangling it everywhere, just like ready for people to see
it. I put it
that.
On the floor so the Roomba is like poop detection to really test it.
But like, it worked, I'm just like, you know? Did that. You did that. I'm like, oh my God, I can't even. Anyway.
Listen, you don't have kids, Sherlyn, you don't have small animals. So you have a very hands-off approach to poop right now.
Yeah, I have
and
a very
poop-free
life.
That changes very quickly once you have like something to take care of.
Yeah. So anyway, excited for that to go out. Like I said earlier this episode, I've been tackling the Microsoft Ability Summit news, which is live right now on the site. Was able to interview Microsoft's Chief Accessibility Officer, Jenny Leigh Fleury, for this post. And I always enjoy talking with Jenny because it's always illuminating. I got a lot of, you know, insight and tips from her when I first, you know, delve into the accessibility space. But at the same time, I also really wanted this piece to kind of communicate to the world at large that, like, yes, there have been a lot of changes in Engadget, but accessibility coverage remains something I'm committed to and that, like, we're still able to do. I asked, like, some, you know, internal, like, questions just to see, like, what the feeling was on that. And, yeah, I mean, it is more of a, as long as it doesn't interfere with your other work, you get to like still cover this. And so I am dedicated to covering this. And I don't say it to like, you know, seek praise or anything. I say it to like reassure people that we continue to be committed to covering like important news like accessibility. I also wanted to shout out that this week we got a bunch of, last week after the last episode, we got a bunch of email from people who were very kindly offering their, you know, services, support, and just very nice words. So we see you, we appreciate you. And if you wouldn't mind a shout out in future episodes, just let us know, because I tend to avoid bringing up people's names just to protect their identity and this sort of stuff. So yeah, continuing to do all of that good work, right, Dev?
Yeah, totally. Totally good work. And you know what? Like, hey, we're still here. We still are gadget fans too. So we're trying to like truck along and do what we can, which brings to mind, like, I want to start highlighting some of our favorite little gadgets on the show weekly or whenever we remember to do it. But one thing that I have found that I have kind of fallen for this week is Anker's MagSafe battery chargers. And these are the ones that kind of like clip onto the back of iPhones, iPhone only at this point, sorry, Android. But they clip onto the back of iPhones and just do wireless charging. And they've been on sale recently. We've had some deal posts up. I'm not sure if those sales are still active, but you could check out Engadget.com. And they were on sale for like $35. And my wife has this problem, like, where her phone is just never charged. Even though she charges overnight, she's just like using it all throughout the day.
Phone is she using?
An iPhone 15. I got her a base, like a normal iPhone 15, but it's just never enough based on like what she's doing with her phone. So I was like, okay, I like the idea of MagSafe battery packs. Let's get you a nice little light one that can keep you topped up throughout the day. So I got her like a cute lilac Anker one. I got, it was on sale for $35. I think it's normally like $50. And as these things come down in price, they're just incredible deals. They're cool things to have around. Keep it in your bag. Keep it charged. Because if you're out and about, you never know when you need a little more power. Like this week, I had to take my daughter to the ER. Like, I did not expect to do that, but
Jesus,
it was 9 p.m.
Sorry.
Yeah, she was just really sick. So we had to go do this visit. I didn't have time to like grab another battery pack, but we were there from like 9 to 3 a.m., you know, like that's just how it goes at the hospital. But after a certain point, I was also like, oh, my phone, if my phone dies, that's not great. That's not great because I'm going to need it for a lot of stuff here. I was worried about battery life because I normally am not out that late without charging midday or something. So you never know. Get a battery pack, folks. They're cheap everywhere.
I think it's also like this is a good point to point out. This is a good place to point out that like the T2 like standard is supposed to bring the MagSafe like feature to Android
magnets
phones.
Are part of T2, so yes, that's coming to Android. This is one case where competition is good too, because Apple, because they added the MagSafe stuff to their wireless charging, I think they are also part of the T2, like the folks behind T2. So when you have companies developing things, like, they can share innovation sometimes.
Yeah.
Better for everybody.
And it's actually a good feature. I will tell you this, MagSafe as a like a feature is surprisingly handy. You have all the pop socket stuff that's so much like better with MagSafe support instead of just like some kind of sticky glue. Wireless charging stands with MagSafe. That's what I use on the daily now. No, it makes a huge difference.
Wireless charging without MagSafe is such a pain because you never know if you're right on the coil or whatever. So, yeah.
So Android manufacturers, listen up. T2's out there. You can use it. So please bring it so everyone can use these. And we also have a power banks guide on Engadget if you wanted to like look for.
For like check chargers. It out. But yeah, get a power bank, get a MagSafe one if you have an iPhone. It's totally worth it. Let's move on to our pop culture picks. What do you want to shout out, Sherlyn?
You're going to laugh.
What reality show are we talking about this week?
I will start. No. Well, damn it. You called me out.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so I want to start first by bringing up that I watched Dune 2 after reading your like wonderful piece. I went to a standard screening at an AMC theater. I mean, it had some Dolby things, but it didn't have the transducers in the recliners. So I wasn't able to feel all of the rumbling that you talk about. That show, though, is really big on rumbling, right? Like, that movie has these very the soundtrack, the sound effects, they're all very, you know, the communication between characters is also so okay. I'll tell you this though, Devendra, before we get to like caught up in the fact that I missed out on the transducer experience, I will say I think Dune maybe like overkilled that sort of sound effect because the two people on either side of me fell asleep. They fell asleep. The recliner seats were so comfortable.
Movie, you know, yeah.
It was very long. I get that. And like, it was sometimes more, you know, of a narrative than it was action and adventure. There were a lot of like action scenes, but the person on my left hella snored. Like just
Is this when somebody I heard, you know, I heard, or was it a stranger?
No, this was a stranger. On my right was my partner who was like, who started to, I could see him falling asleep. I was like, your eyes are closing, stop it. And then on my left was this stranger, and they were like, you would hear like, and then, and I'm like, no.
That's, the New York area theater experience, or if you go to the theater during the day, the senior citizens who are lovely, but I've encountered many who spend their days at the cinema, especially the Angelica Theater right below our office, which is down by the subway station. Something about the combination of the subway rumble plus midday movies, the entire row of older viewers just asleep.
I saw a dinner time screening for What It's Worth, it's and amazing. Maybe that's why.
I don't want to be offensive here. It's just like that was my experience, and like that is part of the charm of seeing midday movies in New York. You know,
I just giggled every time it happened because it would like the snoring would occur during like quiet moments too. So I would just you would hear the snore and then you would hear me go.
You should have recorded that person. Just be like, this is an on the ground Dune 2 review snore.
Oh man, I should have tried.
Should have done it. I talked about the Dolby Cinema, Sherlyn. After all that, you're like, I'm gonna go to a basic ass screening of Dune 2.
I know. I tried for the IMAX. I tried, but they were full. They were
IMAX
like,
is full. Dolby Cinema probably would not be full.
Right. Yeah. Also full. Like anyone that I wanted to find.
That's true.
Because it was
That's
opening true. Weekend. Yeah. It was hard to find. So anyway, if you can, and I'm gonna go try and go back for the transducer experience, right? So you know,
I don't know if it's worth it, but it is worth seeing that movie again. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Watch the movie. Anyway, so moving on to like two things I want to mention really quickly. One, the Avenger rightly called me out that I've been watching some trash reality shows, which is Love is Blind season 6 on Netflix. I mean, if you follow pop culture at all, or if you're in that space at all, you are aware it's been happening. You can see the people just not confronting their own issues. And I've been following that, and it's been very good for me to be the moral police here. And
every time people talk about the show, it sounds like a human petri dish, you know, like more than most reality shows. It's just like you have a whole bunch of weirdos and people who are not like emotionally intelligent in a room. That's what okay. All right.
It will be fodder for me for my next recommendation, which is that I started a personal blog. Hey. And this is my like obvious attempt to get people to go read it, I guess. I will maybe write about my armchair therapy diagnosis.
Is it a blog or is it a newsletter, Sherlyn?
It's currently on Medium, so it is a blog. I am going to treat it as a blog, but I am exploring ways to turn it into a newsletter and find different ways of like engaging,
cool.
I guess.
That's cool. Get more writing out there. I kind of want to do that too. Like, you know, it is very easy when we spend all our days writing about like tech stuff to like just do
so
that.
So heavy.
You know, I get it. Totally get it. What is your blog called and where can we find it?
I was going to say it is medium.com/@Sherlyn Lowe. So CHERLYNNLOW. There's only one post there right now, but I'm going to do like at least 2 a week and something like that. Go ahead and check it out.
Super cool. I kind of want to start up a newsletter powered by Ghost.
Yes, I'm checking out Ghost as well.
Ghost is very cool. I've been thinking about this for a while. I really dislike Substack as a company. And the whole realization recently where people have like, Substack is okay with Nazis. Yeah, they were okay with Nazis 2 years ago, guys. We had this conversation and everybody built their entire newsletter presence around Substack again. So anyway, Substack, not a great company. Ghost is like, I want to like own something on the internet again, you know, like my own little private space.
Exactly.
So I have a WordPress thing, which I never update. And yeah, just think about that. So anyway, let me know how are you publishing stuff online these days, folks? Let us know. Podcastengadget.com. I want to shout out a show that is on Hulu/FX right now. And that is Shogun. As the announcer says, Shogun is it's an adaptation of the very popular novel from decades ago. It was also a miniseries in the 80s. This is a modern retelling of that show. It's still a historical piece, but I have to tell you, if you like Game of Thrones, if you like big historical epics, if you like cool samurai stuff, if you like really lush cinematography and really good storytelling, you should be watching this show. It is fantastic. It is co-created by, co-created by Justin Marks. And he was responsible for Counterpart, which was one of my favorite sci-fi shows on, it was on Stars, I think, a couple of years ago. Counterpart was great. I wish everybody would go see that. But yeah, this is essentially, this is a show about a specific time period in Japan where the shogunate is not around anymore. It is about like dueling clans trying to decide the fate of their area of Japan and the country overall. But it's also at a time where Japan's borders are still closed off, and I don't know if it's technically a soldier, but a sailor working for the British, who wants to like break through Portugal's kind of grip on Japan, and also the Catholic Church's grip on Japan, and kind of open up its borders to fight the Catholic Church. They're also a part of this. They're a foreigner coming into this land where they have no idea. They've never seen, you know, a society that's run like this, like a very high functioning society with huge cities, culture, like customs that they've never seen before. This show is fantastic. It is like reading a giant novel, because there are just so many characters, so many different factions and like perspectives that you have to think about. It's also really well produced, very well written, incredibly well acted. I think this is like a perfect TV show. So it's worth watching. I think you'll like it, Sherlyn. You know, when you're done with Love is Blind, just try something that's like, you know, well written and well produced and well acted.
Yeah.
Shogun on FX/Hulu. It's fantastic and I recommend it.
Well, that's it for our episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. This podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, Mastodon, Blue Sky, all over the place. And I talk about movies at the Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to send me other reality TV series that are equally trash, you can hit me up on X. I am there on, I guess, formerly Twitter, at Sherlyn Low. I also blog medium.com/@Sherlyn Low. And I'm on Threads at Sherlyn Instagram, and also email cher@engadget.com. Speaking of, email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. Bye. So it's eating at the same time as it's peeing, you know what I mean? Is that... God.